Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us on this beautiful Easter weekend. From the Arizona Republic, The Warning Signs Your Trees Could Be in Trouble by Joanna K. Tsouvelis. Severe weather can turn a seemingly healthy tree into a serious hazard. Arborists say many homeowners don't realize a tree is in decline until a storm exposes the problem, sometimes with costly or dangerous results. Board-certified master arborist Jonathan Quinn of Hartney Graymont in Needham, Massachusetts, says the best defense is simply paying attention. You've walked by it a dozen times and it was fine, he said. Now there's a sunken area of bark. That raises some flags. The subtle warning signs homeowners often overlook. Trees rarely fail without giving some kind of signal. According to Quinn, these are the most common red flags. Bark falling off, leaves that look unusually small or unusually large, fewer leaves than normal, leaves changing color or dropping earlier than expected, upright shoots growing at the base or higher up the trunk, mushrooms growing at the base, signs of a type of fungus which can appear as a thin gray or white crust in spring and matures into a brittle, charcoal-like black mass. Quinn says about 90% of tree diseases are caused by fungi. All trees are being attacked by something, he said. It just depends how healthy they are. Like humans, there's always bacteria attacking us, but if we're healthy and taking care of ourselves, our immune system fights them off. Regular watering and proper mulching can help a tree resist disease and stress. When a tree should come down and when it can be saved. Deciding whether to remove a tree depends on more than its appearance. Quinn recommends first assessing what's around it, nearby homes, cars, play areas, or walkways. Sometimes a tree can be preserved through pruning or anchoring. Other times, removal is the safest option. I lean toward preservation, probably more than most other arborists, Quinn said, but if it's keeping you up at night, let's assess it. Homeowners who are unsure should contact a certified arborist or local public works department for an evaluation. The tree species most likely to fail in storms. Some species are more prone to storm damage than others. Quinn says three types of trees make up the majority of failures during storms. White pines are especially vulnerable when they stand alone rather than in groups. Anytime they're not in a group, they have the likelihood of falling despite being healthy, Quinn said. Norway maples are also known for breaking apart, sometimes without warning. Arborists even have a term for it, sudden limb drop. And Dutch and Siberian elms are another pair of species that tend to shed large limbs under stress. Also from the Arizona Republic, celebrate Easter with a cute lollipop garden by Cody Godwin. Easter Sunday falls on April 5th this year. The date of the holiday changes annually and is determined by the first full moon on or after the March equinox. Easter is celebrated on the Sunday following the full moon. No matter how you celebrate the day, bunnies, eggs, and candy are staples in many homes, especially if you have children. Peeps might be the candy that comes to mind when you think of Easter. However, the multicolored marshmallow chicks don't crack the top 10 of most popular treats, according to Instacart. The food delivery service looked at the candies bought from April 14th through the 20th, 2025, and found the most popular Easter candies are, first, Reese's peanut butter eggs, next, Hershey's milk chocolate, Reese's peanut butter cups, Sour Patch Kids, Starburst Jelly Beans, Lindt Gold Bunny Milk Chocolate M&M's, Russell Stover Chocolate Bunnies, Nerds, and Ghirardelli Chocolate. Grow a lollipop garden. Jelly beans are a classic during Easter week. According to Instacart's findings, they jump 863% above their yearly average. If you find yourself adding a bag or two to your cart, consider using some of that candy for this fun Easter activity with the kids in your life, planting a lollipop garden. Go outside and plant some jelly beans the night before the Easter Bunny comes to visit. If you have pets or live in an area with wildlife, plant the jelly beans deep enough so the animals can't easily consume them. Next, fill the area with lollipops of your choice after the kids go to bed or before they wake up the following morning. It'll look like the planted jelly beans sprouted lollipops overnight, which will make the little ones delighted. It's the easiest and maybe even the tastiest plant you'll ever grow. What to fill Easter eggs with instead of candy? However, loading them up with lots of sweets might not be your idea of a happy holiday. If you're trying to steer clear of the sweets or cut back, consider filling the eggs with sugar-free, dietary-friendly items like Lego minifigures, dress-up jewelry, stickers, slime, reward coupons for things like extra screen time, a yes day, movie night, a chore pass, staying up late, and other activities your kids might enjoy. Also from the Arizona Republic, grow your own raspberries in your home garden by Mike Hogan. The only thing better than eating a bowl full of ripe raspberries is being able to harvest those raspberries from bushes in your own garden. While raspberries do not last long once they're ripe, if you can't keep up with eating the ripe berries from your bushes, you can freeze them for later use in pies or fruit salads, or turn them into delicious jams and jellies. While pruning raspberry bushes can be complicated, these plants are relatively tough and forgiving, allowing you to learn as you go. Summer bearing versus fall bearing. Raspberries are a type of bramble or prickly, thorny shrub. Raspberries come in four different colors: red, black, purple, and gold. More importantly, raspberries come in two different types, summer bearing and fall bearing. Fall bearing raspberries are sometimes called ever bearing. Summer bearing raspberries have two types of stems, which are called canes. Floor canes are woody brown canes from the previous year that bear fruit in the current year from late June to August and then die. New green canes that grow in the current year are called primocanes and won't bear fruit until the following year. Fall bearing raspberries bear fruit on the current year's new green canes, allowing you to harvest berries in the first year of planting. Fall-bearing raspberries can be pruned so that they provide a small summer crop on the canes from the previous year and a larger fall crop on the current year's canes, thus the term ever-bearing. Summer-bearing and fall-bearing raspberries have different care and pruning needs, so if you plant both types of berries, be sure to plant them in different rows or groups in your garden or landscape, which will make it easier to prune each type differently. Planting and culture. Raspberries should be planted in early spring. Plants will be available in containers at local garden centers and can also be ordered online from specialty berry growers. Like so many other plants gardeners love, raspberries do best when planted in a full sun location in the garden or landscape, in sandy loam soils with a high organic matter content. When planting raspberries in clay soils with little organic matter, be sure to amend the soil prior to planting with compost or peat moss in the fall before the spring in which raspberries will be planted. Raspberries do not do well in locations with poor drainage, so avoid these types of locations. Avoid planting raspberries in locations where solanaceous crops such as tomatoes, peppers, potatoes, and eggplant have been grown in the past few years, as the soil may contain fungal organisms which can kill raspberry plants. Also avoid locations where strawberries have been grown in recent years. Raspberries should be planted in rows with 2 feet of space between each plant. If you plant more than one row, have 8 feet of space between the rows to allow for good air circulation, which will help prevent fungal diseases from developing. Do not plant raspberry plants too deeply, as raspberry plants have shallow root systems. After planting, prune the canes back to 6 inches and keep the soil moist for 1 to 2 weeks after planting. This is especially important if dry weather occurs at the time of planting. Adding a thin layer of mulch over the root zone of raspberry plants will help maintain soil moisture and control weeds. Fertilizing raspberry plants with a complete fertilizer such as 10-10-10 will provide needed nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Top dressing the root zone of raspberry plants with compost or well-rotted manure will also provide nutrients and improve the quality of the soil. Support needed for canes. Most types of raspberries will require some type of trellis system, especially those called trailing varieties. Steel T-posts available at garden centers and home stores work best. Posts that are 7 feet tall should be placed 8 feet apart and buried at least 12 inches in the ground. 2 or 3 horizontal guide wires should be attached to the posts to provide support for the canes. Individual canes can be tied to the guide wires with cotton string, which will make harvesting much easier. Pruning is critical. Pruning is critical to maintaining healthy, disease-free raspberry plants. Summer-bearing raspberries should be pruned immediately after the fall harvest ends. The canes, which just finished fruiting, should be cut to the ground, and remaining canes should be thinned out in the spring, with three or four of the largest canes remaining in each foot of row. While fall-bearing varieties of raspberries can be pruned to yield two crops each year, you will get a more bountiful crop if you prune to encourage a single harvest in late summer. To do this, cut all canes to the ground in the fall. Then in the spring, after the new canes have started growing, but before the end of July, thin out the new canes to leave just three or four canes per foot of row. With proper pruning and management, raspberry plants will persist in home gardens for many years. From the Chicago Tribune, birding for all groups soar. Accessible walks bring activities, joy to people with mobility and other limitations. Wearing an oxygen pack on her back for her COPD, Marsha O'Bara is leading a group of nature enthusiasts on a mission to see birds. They carry walking sticks on the flat trails, moving at their own pace without pressure or competition and enjoying a sense of community. This is Birding for Everybody, one of numerous such excursions offered each month by the nonprofit Tucson Bird Alliance with Arizona's Pima County. It's part of a growing national movement to help people with physical and other limitations experience birding and nature in general. It's an opportunity for people to get out and see birds without pressure, no matter how long it takes or how many birds we see, said O'Bara, a retired nurse who has been leading the accessible outings for 3 years. She said disabled people often cannot keep up on traditional outings, especially when competitive birders are focused on checking off a list of the greatest possible number of species. For her accessible walks, O'Bara ensures that all trails are easily traversable and bathrooms are open and large enough to accommodate mobility scooters and wheelchairs. She checks on the availability of drinking water, shade, and benches. Once a walk gets underway, O'Bara checks to ensure everyone is keeping up, then modulates the pace as needed. I used to work in rehab, so I usually know what people need, O'Bara said. While the outings are open to those with wheelchairs and mobility scooters, people who use those devices rarely attend the walks, O'Bara said, perhaps because they don't think they'll be able to keep up. But we'd encourage him to come, O'Bara said. Enjoy nature and community. On one of several walks she led in February at Tucson area parks, O'Bara pointed out Phainopepla, a slender crested bird perched on a mesquite tree that adores the bright red berries of desert mistletoe clumped on the branches. Quacking mallards and other ducks swam in ponds or pecked the ground. It's nice to just be outside and not think of anything else, said Ray Gerton, a retired Rhode Island snowbird who spends 4 months in Tucson each winter. She used a walking pole for stability. I'm just slow, she explained. Evelyn Spitzer, a retired Tucson area teacher, used a walking pole for her heart condition and the lingering effects of a recent surgery. The organized effort to share birding with people with accessibility needs dates at least to 2018, when retired Texas teacher Virginia Rose founded the nonprofit Birdability. Rose has used a wheelchair since suffering a spinal injury at age 14. Our vision is that birding be truly for everybody and everybody, regardless of disability, said Kat Fribley, Birdability's executive director. She said participants' limitations include mobility issues, blindness or low vision, chronic illness, intellectual or developmental disabilities, and mental illness. Some are neurodivergent, deaf, hard of hearing, or have other health concerns. Fribley, who uses a mobility scooter for multiple disabilities, said she can go 5 or 6 miles while birding on the accessible paths in her residential community in Iowa City, Iowa. In the winter, I bird on my back deck with my coffee, she said. Other examples of accessible birding include watching from a car, from a canoe, on a river, or simply through a large kitchen window, advocates say. Maps and apps. Birdability has helped compile a crowdsourced map of accessible birding locations nationwide in partnership with the National Audubon Society and offers advice to able-bodied birders on how to be more welcoming and inclusive. The group's website has many other resources and adaptive devices, such as car window mounts for cameras and apps that blind people and others can use to identify and record birdsong. Occupational therapist Friar McGregor recommends binocular harnesses, which are strapped around the back and chest, saying they're easier on the shoulders and neck than binoculars that hang around the neck. McGregor, who has a permanent knee injury, runs Access Birding, which trains nature organizations such as state parks and local Audubon chapters on making trails accessible. Birding by ear. Birding really brings you joy, said Jerry Barriere, 73, a Massachusetts birder who has been blind since birth. There is happiness from being out in nature. Barriere got hooked as a college student when he learned to identify a huge number of bird calls and songs to satisfy the lab requirement for a biology class. He later taught blind and deaf-blind people on how to negotiate the use of laptops and cell phones at the Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown, Massachusetts. He captures avian songs and calls for his website, www.birdblind.org, to help blind bird enthusiasts record and share their own. Last year, he launched the Any Bird, Anybody podcast with his friend Gary Harris. Barriere also helped organize the first national birdathon for blind enthusiasts in the United States. It drew several hundred participants last year who reported the bird calls they heard over 24 hours. The event goes international this May 3rd and 4th. We encourage people to reach out to local organizations to help blind people with the birdathon, he said. A disability can be very isolating. From southwestgardener.com, Sweet Acacia, Love It or Leave It, by Deanne Albin. Sweet Acacia is a tree that people either love or hate. Here's a look at its various attributes and drawbacks so you can decide for yourself whether this tree sounds right for you. And if it is, you'll find everything you need to know about planting and caring for the Chihuahuan desert native in your desert garden. Sweet Acacia is a medium-sized evergreen shade tree that arouses strong feelings. Some people love it, while others don't. It has small, green, fern-like leaves that create pleasant, filtered shade. When in bloom, it's smothered in yellow puffball flowers that smell so delightful they are used as an ingredient in perfumes. It's an extremely tough tree that grows just about anywhere, even in parking lots, disturbed soil, or when surrounded by turf. These trees provide food and shelter for wildlife. Birds use the plant for nesting and cover, and when in bloom, the nectar attracts bees, butterflies, and other pollinating insects. Why I like this plant. Evergreen fern-like foliage. Extremely tough. Fragrant, fuzzy yellow flowers. Attracts butterflies and bees. Things to watch out for. So far, this tree sounds pretty good, and you may be wondering what's not to like. Here are some things you should be aware of before you plant one in your yard. Sweet Acacia can be messy when it drops its pods. Deer and javelina like the pods, and you may not want to lure hungry critters into your yard. Sweet Acacia has 1-inch thorns that can give you a nasty poke. This is not a tree to have around kids, pets, or other high-traffic areas. The pods are non-toxic to humans, but are toxic to pets. When in bloom, trees produce pollen that trigger allergies in some people. It naturally grows as a big shrub, and it's not easy to prune it correctly without professional help. It frequently sends up lots of suckers that need to be kept in check. It's a pioneer plant, which means it's readily established in disturbed areas and can do the same in your yard. It often reseeds, and if you don't remove the numerous volunteers, before you know it, you'll have an acacia forest. It's prone to getting mistletoe, which doesn't kill healthy trees, but it's not a look everyone likes on their trees. While researching Sweet Acacia, I was taken aback to read what Watershed Management Group, an important nonprofit environmental organization in Tucson, had to say about this tree. This tree was once a commonly planted ornamental in Tucson, but has fallen out of favor. It can be prone to a short lifespan, often sends out many fast-growing suckers from its base and trunk, and portions of the tree will often die off. Many trees in Tucson are not aesthetically pleasing, with dead sections, knobby trunks and branches, suckering, dark, scabby branches. Whoa! On the other hand, Thomas Jefferson, one of America's earliest agronomists, was so enamored of it that he called it the most delicious flowering shrub in the world and wrote that it was the only plant besides the orange that I would take the trouble of nursing in a greenhouse. Optimal growing conditions. If you're thinking of adding a sweet acacia to your garden, you need to find a suitable place that will keep your tree healthy and looking good while minimizing maintenance for you. Here are the key factors to keep in mind. Temperature. Sweet acacia should be grown in USDA hardiness zone 7 through 11. It thrives in extreme heat and survives temperatures down to 15 degrees Fahrenheit. Sun exposure. Sweet acacias are sun-loving. They don't mind the reflected heat from garden walls or buildings, but they do not do well in less than full sun. Size and growth rate. Sweet acacia is a moderate grower that reaches a mature size of 25 feet high by 25 feet wide. Unlike many acacias, it's relatively long-lived with a lifespan of around 50 years. Acacias typically live 20 to 40 years. And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know we feature stories each week from the terrific book, Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. The story is called Black Tulips. It was written by Karen Clavers Owens, translated by Philip Clavers. There's a quote here from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. It is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Black tulips. When I was a child growing up in the Netherlands, I often begged my mother to tell me this story about an experience her family had at the end of World War II. During the terrible last winter of the German occupation, the Hunger Winter, food was very scarce in the Netherlands. People were so desperately hungry they began to eat small animals and many things not normally considered edible, including tulip bulbs. People discovered the bulbs could be cooked like potatoes or turnips or even eaten raw. For centuries, my mother's family, the Vandervelds, had owned a highly successful tulip business which provided jobs for many in our village of Ridderkerk. Their bulbs were popular throughout Europe and abroad, and the family name was known far and wide. But the war shut their business down, and during the winter of hunger, my grandfather, Arnoldus, donated all his tulip bulbs to feed the hungriest villagers. All, that is, except for a few irreplaceable bulbs. For years, Arnoldus had been trying to cultivate a black tulip, something no gardener had ever been able to do. He was now very close. By careful selection, he had created a dark purple tulip. These few bulbs he guarded vigorously to prevent people from stealing them for food. He did not even give them to his family to eat because they would make just one meager meal, and eating them would destroy his chance of restarting his business and restoring his village after the war. One day, underground Radio Orange announced that the war was over. There was some great rejoicing, but more hardships were still to come. The German forces that had occupied and terrorized our country for 5 long years started to withdraw, battalion by battalion. But as they pulled back, some soldiers deserted and fled toward Germany, sacking and looting as they went. There was much destruction, and the Dutch people still faced grave dangers. My grandfather, Arnoldus, looked at his pale, thin children and realized that the hunger could continue for a long time as the war left poverty in its wake. He wondered if it might be time to feed his precious bulbs to his children. Certainly, it would be better than losing the bulbs to the marauding bands of fleeing German soldiers. After hours of agonizing, he made his decision. He seized a shovel and went into the garden. There he found my mother, Alberta, then just 7, looking flushed and agitated. "Papa, Papa, I must tell you something," Alberta said. Over her shoulder, Arnoldus saw a band of drunken, looting soldiers coming toward them down the street. He whispered to Alberta to run inside the house and frantically began digging for his bulbs. Over and over, his shovel came up empty. He was too late. Someone had already stolen them. Crazed with grief and rage, he ran toward the street, screaming, "They have stolen my tulip bulbs!" Alberta, watching from the doorway, cried out and ran to stop him. Before she could reach Arnoldus, a German soldier raised his pistol and shot him. Although the German surrender had been signed, a curfew was still technically in effect, and my grandfather had violated it. Arnoldus survived his wounds and mended slowly. When he could finally leave his bed, he sat by the window, staring out into the garden. He so regretted that he hadn't given the bulbs to the family sooner. The war was over and spring was coming, but life remained very hard. Many houses had been bombed. There was little food and few jobs. Finally, the weather warmed, and Arnoldus was able to sit outside. Alberta stayed close to him, attending to his every need, rarely leaving him even to play with her friends. She had become quiet and reserved, although she had been a happy, bubbly child before the war. Sometimes she would try to cheer her father by pointing to the pile of rubble next door, all that was left of their neighbor's bombed house. She reminded her father that at least their family still had each other and a roof above their heads. Arnoldus realized the truth in her words and often glanced over at the ruins to remind himself of how lucky they had been. One day, he noticed something sprouting among the broken bricks and concrete. He pointed out the green leaves to Alberta. Suddenly, all her reserve left her. She began to cry hysterically. Between convulsive sobs, she told him that these were his black tulip bulbs. He held her close and listened with amazement as she told her story. Just before her father was shot, Alberta had been in the garden when a friendly German soldier had approached her. Karl Meyer was stationed in the family's neighborhood during the occupation. He had Vandeveld bulbs in his own garden back home in Germany and appreciated their value. Karl had watched as Arnoldus gave away the precious bulbs to feed his neighbors, and he suspected that there were many more hidden away. The soldier warned Alberta that a band of German looters was on its way down the street. He urged her to hide the remaining bulbs away from the yard, which would surely be searched, and he begged her not to mention his name to anyone, as he could be court-martialed for his warning. Just then, the laughing and shouting of drunken soldiers could be heard coming down the road. Karl Meyer fled. With no time to summon her father, Alberta scrabbled in the dirt with her bare hands, scooped up the bulbs from their hiding place, and reburied them in the rubble next door. As she clambered back over the fence into her own garden, she found her father digging with a shovel. She tried to tell him what she'd done, but he was so intent on his work that he ignored her. For some time, it was uncertain whether Arnoldus would survive his gunshot wound. When he began to recover, Alberta went to retrieve the bulbs, knowing that seeing them would raise his spirits. She climbed over the fence and gasped with horror. An unstable wall had collapsed on the spot, covering the bulbs. It seemed impossible to the little girl that anyone could ever move the heavy slab. Overwhelmed with sorrow, Alberta decided not to tell anyone what she had done. However, during the last cruel days of winter, ice must have formed in the cracks of the wall, gently forcing them apart. With the warmth of spring, the ice had melted, and the tender shoots had made their way up toward the sun. Arnoldus had survived, and so had his bulbs. Now father and daughter stood looking at the young green leaves. It took some time, but my grandfather rebuilt his business, starting with those few bulbs. The rare dark purple tulips eventually became an enormous source of income for the people in Ridderkirk and provided very much-needed jobs. The recovery of Ridderkirk persuaded its people that there could again be happiness after so much misery, and new life after so much death. As the tulips rose from the ruins and came to bloom again, so did the Netherlands. Although the Vandervelds tried to locate Karl Meyer, he was never found, but the family did find a way to honor his courage and kindness. When my mother's little brother was born the following year, the grateful family named him Carol, the Dutch version of Carl. That's called Black Tulips, written by Karin Clabbers Owens, translated by Philip Clabbers, one of the many stories that make up chicken soup for the gardener's soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a wonderful Easter weekend. Be safe and healthy, and we'll be talking with you soon.